Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we are recording the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on the memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 19th, 2019, is Joe Miller. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Can you provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Sure. I started in corrections in, I think it was November of 79, and I retired in 2007. During my career, from the beginning, I started off as a corrections officer trainee, and I started off at the State Correctional Institute at Camp Hill, and worked there as a trainee, and at that time they didn't have a training program, so you worked as a trainee until they felt you were strong enough to be able to handle the everyday duties. From a trainee, I went to CO1, a cell block officer, and then got promoted to a sergeant. I don't remember the years. I don't know if that's important.
That's okay. But
as a sergeant, I was a sergeant at the time of the riots in 89.
Okay.
And then after the riots in 89, I started working with the CERT program and helped train all the institutions for the CERT program, and worked out at a security office, department headquarters for a while. And from there, I went to SCI Frackville as a major of the guard and retired from there.
Weren't you the chief of security at one point?
I was acting.
Okay.
Yeah, I was the assistant chief.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I was acting twice.
Okay, wow. Sometimes
we
act a lot of times.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to the Camp Hill riot. It's around 2:33 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what's happening?
The first day, I was actually coaching football at a local high school. We actually had a game. I just got off shift at 2 o'clock, and I got to the high school about 2:45, so we had a game, and I was on the sideline coaching. And during the game, I seen all these. Well, the high school that I coached at was parallel to a major route going through Harrisburg, and I seen all these law enforcement vehicles flying up the highway. I'm wondering what the heck is going on, and it just kept going. And I'm noticing this during the game, and then all of a sudden I see the Lifeline helicopter fly over. I see the state police helicopters flying over, and they're all going in that direction. You know, all the while I'm thinking there's something big going on somewhere. And then my wife pulled up in the parking lot and came down on the field and told me, she said, "Joe, something's going on at Camp Hill. You need to call them." So, you know, I quick ran off the field, went into school, and called the control center, and they said, "Yeah, we have places burning down. You need to come in right away." Mm-hmm. So I got in my car and went home, quick put my uniform on. And as I'm driving up the road, I mean, it's unbelievable, all these police vehicles going in the same direction. And as I got to the South Bridge, you can actually see smoke, and you can actually see fire. And I'm thinking, you know, this is something that I never thought would ever happen to Camp Hill, but it's happening right now. So I finally get there, and I remember I ran in the main gate, and they said, "You need to go to the armory to get a shotgun." So I came back out the gate. When the armory was across from the main gate, got a shotgun. I'm back in the institution, and I remember walking into the institution, just watching it burn and smoke everywhere and screaming and hollering. Yeah, I get inside the institution, and I'm no sooner inside the institution, but I'm pretty sure this was the first day, I hear a voice from the infirmary, which is, as soon as you go through the main gate, there's a chapel on your left and the infirmary's on your right. I heard yelling, "You know, Sarge, you know, we're up here, can you get us out?" And I'm looking around, and here there was officers, I guess they were trapped up on the second floor. So I'm not quite sure who was with me, but, you know, we went into the infirmary and were able to get them out. And then from there I went down the walks, and there was inmates running everywhere, throwing rocks, bolts, all kinds of stuff at us. I got down to the control center, and that's where I seen some state police were there, local police were there, and people weren't even in uniform. State police had t-shirts on. I mean, they just got deployed and just came right from where they were at. And at that point, what we were trying to do was just to keep the inmates away from the control center. They were making runs from group 2 and 3, just running across the walks and throwing stuff. So from there, we worked our way up toward E Gate. And when we got to E Gate, they had it barricaded and they had it covered, but you could still see in the group 2 and 3 compound area. And in the compound area, it was your worst nightmare. You've seen a whole bunch of officers sitting on the ground, handcuffed, blindfolded, and just inmates just walking around them, just punching them in the face, kicking them in the back of the head, just abusing them. And you're standing there, and you can't do nothing because you can't get through. And I can remember people saying, even asking me, you know, can we shoot? Can we shoot? What can we do? And it's like, we have shotguns. You know, a shotgun's not a precision weapon. I mean, you pull the trigger on a shotgun, you're going to take out anybody that's close. So we weren't sure what to do, and there was no direction being given at that time what to do. So you were helpless. You're standing there watching this. I mean, you were yelling, you know, get away from them. And what sticks in my mind and sticks in my mind to this day is I still hear people on my radio, you know, yelling for help. They can see you, but you can't see them. Just yelling for help. Just come and get me. I'm over here. I'm in this cell block. Can you come and get me?
And you couldn't go anywhere.
No, you couldn't. We were stuck right there at E-Gate. We stayed there for a while. And then there was word that I heard over the radio that some officers were trapped up on top of the gym roof. The gym roof, I think it was connected to the kitchen, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My lieutenant told me to head over there, so I go over there, and there was two officers that were on the second floor that were, inmates were trying to get at them from below, and so they made their way up through the ceiling and onto the roof. So we used a fire truck from Lower Allen Township, and I got on the ladder, and they pushed the ladder up onto the roof, and we were able to help them get off the roof and down to safety. That was Jerry.
Okay.
Jerry Kostlak and Nelson Berlin, I think, was the other one.
This was still the first night.
This was still the first night, yeah. And you have to excuse me, sometimes that all runs together because it was similar the second night, but it was worse.
Okay.
But so some of I might have it on the wrong day, I'm not sure, but. So somehow the inmates went away from the compound area, and we were able to get through. We were able to get through the gate, and start trying to find the hostages at some point in there. I'm just drawing a blank right now of how this happened, but the first night it. The state police were there. There was a lot of stuff going on. But then I'm just trying to figure out how it happened. But all of a sudden, the first night, then the inmates just disappeared and scattered back into the cell blocks. And we were able to just go cell block to cell block and just start putting inmates in their cells.
And when you say putting them in their cells, it wasn't necessarily putting Joe Miller in the cell he was in, or even alone?
No, it was, you would just, if the inmates, as you're going down the tier, now this was a whole bunch of corrections officers and a whole bunch of state police. We just went cell block to cell block and just went in the block and just start shoving inmates in the cells. And sometimes we put 2 and 3 and 4 in a cell, mm-hmm. whether it was theirs or not.
Right.
And then sometimes we would just put inmates in the cell and go about 5 cells down and you turn around and they're out already. You know, they were just opening the doors. You know, they had the run of the whole institution most of the day. So the cell locking mechanisms were tampered with. So then we would just pull them out of there and put them in another cell that worked. So we did this at all 6 cell blocks. We just went in. It took a long time. I mean, it didn't end until, I think, in the morning. So we put everybody in their cells. And once we got everybody in the cells, I'm not going to say once we got everybody secured because it wasn't secure. And people made no bones about it. We told them, we said, look, these cells, we can hear clicking as we're walking out of the blocks. You know, inmates changing cells. Mm. The cell locking mechanisms weren't working right. So after that, I remember, and I'm saying after that, that took all night long.
Right.
But it was the same. We did the same thing every cell block. We just went in as a group, put all the inmates in their cells, and just try to secure them in as best as we can. And then it came time, came over the radio that we had to feed the inmates. And that didn't really sit well with a lot of people. But that was the decision that was made by the administration, that they're going to send boxes of food over and that we were going to have to go in the cell block, cell to cell, and hand out food. Mm-hmm. So we didn't feel comfortable doing it because you were walking in a cell block that wasn't secure. I mean, if you're going in there by yourself, you can end up being a hostage again. So we reluctantly did it. You know, we did it because we respected our captains and they asked us to do it. They said, look, I don't want to do it either, but this is what the administration wants. We got to do it. So we did it. So a whole group of us went down and we fed the inmates. And after we finished with that, you know, we did some searching and stuff just to make sure that we could lease, because it was, I remember us trying to count and it was almost impossible to count. I mean, I don't know how we cleared count that night. That'd be a good question to ask somebody.
I don't think they did for several days.
I don't think so. I don't see how we could have.
Right.
And after that, it was just, you know, just trying to get information about what was going on and what went on. And then at some point towards the morning, I think, we got word that we had to go pick up some inmates and take them over to the administration office. This deputy's office or the superintendent's office. Deputy's office.
Inside
the prison.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I guess these were the inmates that were negotiating with whoever during the night. So I don't know how many inmates. I'd say maybe eight inmates. Well, we went around the cell blocks and rounded them up. And then we escorted them over, and I think it was the deputy's conference room over beyond the control center area. So we get in there, and they all sit down at the table, and the superintendent, deputy, and major guard, a bunch of other people sitting there also, and they just rehashed the night, and the inmates just sat there and was listening to what the superintendent was saying. And then so all the while we're thinking, you know, after they're done with them, we're going to probably just take them right up the hallway to the restricted housing unit. They're going to be locked up until we find out what went on, until we get all the information. You know, why let these guys go? They were ringleaders. You know, if they're negotiating with you, that means they have a say on what's going on out there. So, you know, the meeting's over, and the superintendent says, do we have your word that this won't happen again? And I remember looking at my partner like, what? And the inmates are like, oh yeah, no, this won't happen again. Nope, you have our word. So the superintendent looks at me and says, take him back to the cell block. And I waited a minute and I said, take him back to the cell block or take him back to the RHU? And he said, no, take him back to the cell block. So reluctantly, we walked him back out of the control center and we're heading across the walks to groups 2 and 3. And they're laughing and joking. It's, you know, just making light of the whole thing that just happened. So we get over by E Gate, which is right next to E Block. E Block borders the walkway by E Gate, and there's inmate cells on the side of E Block. So these inmates, we got them that far, and they yell up into E Block saying, hey, let pass the word. We didn't get shit. They didn't give us nothing. We're coming back out tonight. And they're yelling that to everybody, everybody they've seen. So we put them in cells, we report that back there, and nothing was, they didn't act on it. And then the rest of the night, you know, we did some searching, I remember, and some interviewing, and then towards the morning, they said that they're gonna keep some officers over in the manor house just to make sure everything is okay. And so, I remember I was at the manor house. And then at some point during the day, after the first night, they told us that we can go home, get some sleep for a couple hours, and then come back in. So I feel like I'm forgetting something, but...
No, it sounds right so far.
So I go home, and of course, you know, the forgotten piece of the whole situation of being a corrections officer in law enforcement. Your family's a mess. You know, my wife was a mess. So happy to see me. I said, yeah, everything's good. I'm okay. You know, Everything's good. Just want to get some sleep. So I remember going to sleep and then her coming and waking me up saying, hey, it's Camp Hill. You got to go back again. I'm like, come on, this isn't even funny. She said, no, you got to go back again. And they said on the phone that it's worse than it was the night before. So you got out of bed, get your clothes back on. And I can't remember what time it was, maybe 5, 6 o'clock, somewhere around there. Again, we got to get on the highway, and it was packed with law enforcement the night before. This night, it was just law enforcement on the highway. I mean, it was packed with vehicles and all going in the same direction. So we get there, and the fire's worse. The smoke is worse. You can see the fire from anywhere. And so
now that it's October, it's dark now at night at 6:30.
Yeah, and it's beautiful weather.
Yeah.
I mean, for October, it was pretty nice out, too. So, which made it easier for the inmates to stay out and not have to worry about it. So, you know, you were afraid of what you were going to see. And so, you know, we pulled in the parking lot. And at that point, when I pulled in the parking lot, I got out of the car, went in the main gate, and they just gave you a shotgun. And they just said, go inside. They had them there for you. And the inmates were right at the door. As you walked in, you had to push inmates away just to get into the institution. There was inmates running everywhere. The whole jail's lit up with fire and smoke. And it's just, there's just inmates running everywhere. So we start moving down, and we can see smoke coming out of the control center area. So again, we were told, you know, head down that area. Just make sure that the inmates don't get in control. And now droves of inmates. We're like making runs from group 2 and 3, coming across and just, you know, throwing stuff at us. Again, we had shotguns, right? Still not sure what to do with the shotgun. Do I hit somebody with it? What do I do with it? From there, you know, we were there for a while, and I remember standing next to a Steelton High Spire police officer, to state police CERT team members who didn't even have a uniform on. And there was just a bunch of officers there, dogs from other agencies. And we're just trying to keep inmates away from the control center area. And then, all of a sudden, we start hearing banging, like real loud bangs. And I remember stepping away from the control center and looking up, and I think it was like C or B block or whatever. And you can see inmates in their cells with sledgehammers banging out the windows. And then the window would fall out, and they would pop out the window. And then you seen torches. They were just torching lines of cells, just taking their windows out, taking the doors down. I mean, just inmates were, you're standing in front of control center, and inmates were jumping on the ground next to you, coming out of nowhere. I mean, it was a nightmare. It really was. So I'd just like to put this in here, too. Can you believe that all these officers had shotguns and plenty of pockets full of ammunition? And we all had the restraint not to use it. I mean, that's remarkable.
Yes.
It really is. And I'll say it until I die. It's remarkable. You know, they say, you know, we're undisciplined and all this kind of stuff. Nah, there was some loose cannons that had shotguns in their hands and handled themselves professionally. So
this night was supposed to be the night that about 20 to 30 institutional personnel were stuck inside control.
Mm-hmm.
So you get into that point, how the inmates.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and actually, while we were there, one of our captains, and he was a larger captain, actually fit through the key room bars. I mean, and there's not much room to fit through there, but he had to get out of there, and he actually wiggled his way out through the key room window.
Wow.
And to this day, we don't know how he did it, but he did it. So from there. I got a call on the radio saying that the state police, that inmates are taking the bricks out of the kitchen tower that's on the yard, on the main yard, and they're throwing smoke and lit fire up into the tower, trying to smoke the tower officer out. So my leader was Lieutenant Sunday at the time, said, can you take state police, state troopers, the back way to the yard and clear them inmates away from the tower, because the officer says he only has 3 rounds of ammunition left, and there's 1,000 inmates out there trying to get in at them. So we went from there, and I took them around the back of the education building, you know, the back way to the yard, and we got on the yard, and sure enough, they were throwing it. As a matter of fact, the tower was like fire was coming out of the catwalk going around. So we quick made entry to the yard, and we just moved all the inmates away. You know, we had shotguns, we chambered rounds, didn't pull a trigger, just chambered rounds. And then we also had the Harrisburg International fire truck with us, which it's a huge vehicle made out of lead, I think. It's made to go into any situation. And it came in with us into the yard, and it used its cannon in the front, water cannon, to clear inmates away from the tower and also put the fire out in the tower. So, you know, we were able to do that, and luckily that worked out well. And then we just cleared all the inmates to the back of the yard. And after we did that, you know, we started bringing inmates out to clear the yard. And we were bringing inmates out, you know, five or six at a time, putting them against the fence, searching them, putting flex cuffs on them, and just sending them on their way. And the officers were just escorting them to areas where they can hold them, just to get them off the yard. And again, I probably shouldn't have been back there, but being that I had to guide the state troopers through the facility, because I knew the facility, they didn't, I ended up with them. So then we come out of the yard, and we're at the Jim Road gate. And then I remember hearing shots fired in the kitchen, because there was inmates in there, and the CERT team made entry into the kitchen.
That was the state police.
State police CERT team, and cleared the kitchen out. And then they came back out, and then we're all at Jim Road gate. Not Jim Road gate, we're at the yard gate. The next gate up is the Jim Road gate. So we're positioned there, you know, nobody behind us. We cleared all that area out. So now all these inmates are in front of us behind Jim Road gate, which was barricaded, I mean, clear up to the top with all kinds of stuff, desks, metal. And we're standing there, and I hear a voice from, you remember the modular units that were burnt to the ground? As all it was a pile of rubble and just smoking. That's all it was. But I hear somebody yelling my name, you know, "Hey, Sarge, Sarge." See, the state police had helmets on. They didn't, nobody knew who they were, but I didn't have a helmet on, so he recognized me. So I go over to the pile of rubble, and I remember stepping on the first piece, and the bottom of my shoes, just the rubber just melted because it was so hot. But he was laying underneath all these boards, and he's like, "Hey, I just want to let you know, don't go through that gate. The inmates have a propane tank buried in the rubble at the Jim Road gate, and as soon as you guys get there, they want you to go there. They're going to open a propane tank and throw a match in, and you're all going to blow up." I'm like, "Are you serious?" And he's like, "Yeah." He said, "I'm telling you, don't." I said, "Okay." I said, "You know, thanks for the information." I said, "Do you want to come out of there?" He said, "No, not yet." I said, "Do you know where any of the hostages are?" And he says, "Yeah." He says, "I know where just about all of them are." So he gave me a lot of information about, you know, the propane tank and the pile, and then information about where the hostages were. So I was relaying this, and that was another problem. It worked out pretty well, though, that I had Captain Reagan and Major Hazen with us, because all the information I was getting, I didn't know what to do with it. So I gave it to them, and then they relayed it to wherever the command post was. So through the course of the night, I kept getting information from them. And then finally, I think the command post wanted him over there to talk to him. So we pulled him out of the rubble and got him over there. But he basically told us some good information about where the hostages were. He didn't know if they were all alive. Matter of fact, he said two of them were dead, and which wasn't true. And so from there, we were at the yard gate, and inmates were just throwing lit pieces of stuff at us, throwing bolts at us, screws, nails. Every once in a while, they would pop out with a chainsaw, fire it up, and just point it at us. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, I worked there for a while, they knew me. They're like, "Yeah, come on in, Miller. You know, well, you know, you can't kill all of us, you know." And I'm like, you know, just standing there. I didn't want to say anything, you know, because it was the state police's ball game at that time. I was just with them because helping them get to where they wanted to go. And so I'm not quite sure what time of the morning. Now, a lot went on up until then, but it was mainly us getting pelted with stuff and just getting information back and forth from this inmate. And somewhere in there, the decision was made that we were going to storm the institution. And we were going to go through Jim Roadgate, and then another group is going to go through the E-Gate, the E-Gate area.
So essentially from both sides.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so we're in position, and what had happened was, like I kept telling them, there's a propane tank there. We don't want to go that way. They said, no, don't worry. The Harrisburg International Fire Truck is going to take care of that propane tank. So once the assault started, the Harrisburg International Fire Truck went first and just opened up this cannon, and it's probably about this big in the front, of just water, thick water, and it just blew the whole gate down. There was a propane tank in there, blew the propane tank out of the way. Inmates were just scattering. They're just running because they didn't expect us to be able to get through the gate. They expected us to hit the gate on foot, and then they were going to blow us all up. So they're scattering. And as soon as we got through the gates, that's when shots were fired at the inmates. I probably went ahead a little bit. I actually had a shotgun at the time, and the shotgun was taken away from me. And
from
me.
But
it
who?
Was from, I think it was Captain Kerstetter. And the state police said it wouldn't be a good idea that one of your officers has a weapon and we're going in ready to shoot, because he has to work here for the rest of his life, rest mm-hmm. of his career, and he doesn't want to be the one that shot an inmate and then going to work the next day.
Right.
Which, when they explained it to me that way, because I'm going to be honest with you, I wasn't crazy about giving up the shotgun, but when they explained it to me that way, it's like, you're right, and I handed over the shotgun.
But it wasn't just you then, it was other...
Yeah, but I couldn't see. I couldn't tell who else was around.
Right.
I don't know who else was there, to be honest with you. I don't. And it's dark. You
right.
can't see anything.
And it's smoky.
Smoky, fire's still burning. So you get through the gate, and then shots start ringing out. And then, it went from craziness to screaming and yelling and popping with fires and banging and chainsaws and torches. You know, you can hear all that. Helicopters flying over. It went completely silent. After all the shots were fired. And as all I remember seeing was inmates just scattered, laying on the ground, moaning and groaning.
And this was about at...
Right when the sun came up, I think.
Yeah,
it was right when the sun came up. So, okay, we started securing the ones that were shot. And then E-Gate came through. And then we made our way to the front of the kitchen. And we formed a big line. And from there, the decision was made to have the inmates come out of the cell blocks. With their hands on top of their head, and then lay down in the compound area. So that started to happen. K block opened its doors first, or J, I'm not sure. And then, because it started to be a rush, and then they said, whoa, 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 you know, just one at a time. And the door opened, and just inmates just start coming out. See all these brown people in browns coming out with their hands up in the air. So I'm standing there, like, nah, I'm not knowing what should I do? Should I run out? Should I handcuff him? What should I do? And then all of a sudden, I noticed the one person in browns coming out of cell block. It was Harold Maurer, one of the hostages, who we thought was dead. And it was him coming out. So I yelled to, I'm not sure if it was Captain Kerstetter, if it was Major Reagan. I said, hey, that's an officer there. That's an officer there. Don't shoot, you know. He's not going to his knees. He was just, like, roaming around. So... You know, I just ran out and grabbed him and pulled him back into, and I remember when I grabbed him, his face was like swollen, his eyes were shut. And at first he was like, you know, I don't want to go, who are you? And it's like, I said, it's Joe Miller. And then he recognized my voice and he said, okay. So pull him behind the line and then I think, Officer Campbell came out after that. and then just all the inmates just start piling out and just laying on the ground. And then just we were going out. The officers that were there were going out just grilling all the inmates, saying, hey, where's this hostage at? Where's this hostage at? Where's Campbell? Where's Arnold? Where's all these people at? And then we were able to get some good information about where they were at and told the state police, and they went and got them. So... we just start handcuffing, flex cuffing the inmates that were laying out there until everyone was out of the cell blocks, and we went through the cell blocks and cleared it out. Now I'm saying that like it took an hour, but can you imagine? It took several hours.
Because people said that they were also raiding and looting a commissary and then taking that all back to their cells. Oh, so they were a complete mess.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Rotting food and mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. And they were wet. And
that's why there was a lot of rumors going around that some hostages were dead, because you can smell dead. You know that smell, like a dead animal? Mm-hmm. You can smell it. But here, what it was is they hit the kitchen and they took all the hamburger out. And they hid it in the plumbing chases in the blocks.
Ew.
With all that heat and it cooked and then it rotted. Because we thought for sure we had a body in one of the crawl spaces. We opened it up and it was just like 4 pounds of hamburger.
Ew.
Sitting in there, yeah. So all the inmates came out and there was a lot of yakking back and forth, and inmates were yelling at each other, you know, blaming them for this. They're blaming each other. They were starting to get a little unruly with each other, because we found out that there was some infighting between some of the groups that were in charge of the inmates during the riot, and that was sort of worked to our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got everybody handcuffed, and I think we took them down to the main yard and just put them out there. And I can remember this like it was yesterday. And the last inmate went through the gate. You know, I can't remember if I was sitting with somebody or I was by myself, but I remember there was a 5-gallon bucket. And I just sat down in a 5-gallon bucket and I looked around. And I'm gonna be honest with you, I started crying. I'm like, I have nowhere to work tomorrow. You know, where am I gonna go to work? They just burnt this institution down. I don't have a job anymore. Not only did they, you know, destroy some of my friends' lives who were officers there, but I have nowhere to work. Can't work here anymore. This place is a mess. You know, that looked a lot worse then. But when you were looking at it, it's like, there's no way this is going to be a jail again. Because it was just, you know, it was holes in walls and things were actually still burning.
Yeah.
You know, part of the fence in the yard was busted through. So, you know, you just got to the point where you're like, I always thought that this would never happen at Camp Hill, and it just happened. You know, it's like something's impossible until it happens. That's so true about this situation that we were in.
When did you finally get to go home?
So after we got the inmates out into the yard, then I guess it was decided that the state police would guard them out there and local law enforcement, because they were getting relieved. We weren't getting relief because there was no one to relieve us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was, I think, 200 and some officers injured in the riot. And, you know, some people didn't want to come back to work. Some people didn't want to come to work. And I'm not going to judge them. You know, I'm not saying that it was a picnic. You know, I was scared just like everybody else was. But we came to work.
Right.
Hold on a second. So we couldn't leave until there was enough local law enforcement and state police there to watch them out in the yard. So once that happened, then we were able to go home. And then we went home, and then they said, just come back in tomorrow morning for your shift. So we came back in the next morning, and inmates were still out in the yard. And then we did a lot of searching. I did a lot of moving inmates. Then after a while, then they started identifying ringleaders, and this person did that. Being that I was acting lieutenant on group 2 and 3, it was my job to go get these inmates who they were pulling out to interview and question or lock up or transfer, one or the other. So we did that for the next few days, and we were working 12-hour shifts, I remember.
Yeah.
And then that's basically what we did. We just moved inmates around the whole time.
And then Saturday, I believe, Friday night into Saturday, they were starting to plan to ship the inmates out.
We got them ready. We got them all strip searched. And we started loading up buses.
But there was a time there where they weren't able to do count. They couldn't. They were missing an inmate.
Yep.
One inmate.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there must have been an inmate snitch, that in the middle of it, they just took him out to Cumberland County Prison.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff White was one of the transporting officers.
Oh, okay.
And he never gave up that he did that until finally he was told, well, if you want to keep your job, you better tell us about it. And sure enough, then after he gave that information and who it was, because they knew who they were looking for,
right,
then the count cleared, but it was several days later.
I never knew that, and that's something.
Yeah,
the basic everyday stuff in the institution for 3 or 4 days, I was totally out of touch. you know, other than what you heard on the radio. And what I heard on the radio was mostly officers crying for help, which I still, you still hear it to this day. Mm-hmm. You can hear their voices. After that, we start processing the inmates, and they were being shipped out to other facilities throughout the country, you know, California, all over the place, Kentucky, everywhere. And just the coordinating of getting the buses in and getting the inmates on the buses with the proper paperwork and moving them out, it was a job. And the weather was nice,
right?
Too. It was very difficult.
Because the records office was damaged, wasn't it?
Yep. And, you know, a lot of these inmates have separations, and you can't, you know, the records are a mess. You can't tell who's who. I mean, I remember the one time that the one bus driver was stopped coming in the gate because he was a relative of the one on the inmates that he was transporting. Yeah, so it was, you know, a lot of this stuff was transpiring. And but, you know, in their defense, didn't do this before. It's the first time we ever did it.
Right.
You know, and another thing, too, and if whoever's listening to this, is the forgotten people are the hostages and their families. That, you know, somehow the department has to come up with something where in any situation that causes a trauma to a staff member and their family, that the department does their part in following up with their families, because it just takes its toll. I mean, the people, like, we tried as officers and coworkers just to take them out for dinner, and the pain that it causes them, it's unbelievable. And I think I told you about the one hostage whose wife, you know, couldn't turn the lights off in her house all night long because her husband wouldn't let her, couldn't shut a door because he didn't want to be enclosed in an area because he was kept in an enclosed area and beat for days. And, you know, couldn't sit in the car because as soon as the car doors closed, he would run out. You don't want to be shut in. And in this situation, like I had told you, that he had a 5-speed truck and his wife didn't know how to drive it. And they had family from out of state, so there was no one there to help them other than their coworkers, which is the right thing to do. We should do that. But then there should be a mechanism in there somewhere where the department has something in place, like a procedure that if this happens, here's what we do. We follow up with the hostages and their families and making sure that they have what they need to deal with what they're dealing with.
Right.
Because they're dealing with a broken person. I mean, if they were hostage for any length of time, you know, they're not thinking right, and they're not thinking rationally. So it was an eye opener for me, that's for sure.
Tell me about debriefings. What kind of debriefings did they have back then, immediately thereafter?
There's counselors on site, and matter of fact, they wanted all the officers who were there to go up and visit a counselor. And
was
I don't
it
know.
An actual prison counselor?
I think they were from throughout somewhere.
Okay.
And there was inspector general's offices were there too, so it was confusing, because, you know, the inspector generals there were there wanting to know what the administration did during the riot, and then it turns out later on then they want to know what you did during the riot, and it was like conflicting, it was confusing. So but the counselors were there just for the staff, and you were asked to go up there and be interviewed. You know, I personally refused to be interviewed because I thought that I would have to answer a question honestly, and then they would tell me I have to take 6 months off from work. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do that to my fellow officers, because our guard force was depleted to begin with. There was no one relieving us, no one able to come into work. So, you know, I refused to be interviewed, and some people followed my way, and they didn't get interviewed either, and some people did, and went in there and they said, take 4 months off from work. You can't come back in the institution until you see me. So it created some problems because a lot of people took advantage of it. And but after that, then it was the part of, okay, do we still have an institution left? Do we still have a job? And that's when Superintendent Beard came, and I think it was Deputy Kyler. We were told that the current administration was relieved of their duties, and then Superintendent Beard and Kyler came.
And McCullough.
And that is when the institution changed, when they got there. And the reason I say that is because for the first time, I can personally say it too, but we had administrative staff coming up to us saying that, hey, what do you think about this? Should we do this? What kind of concerns do you have with it? They were actually asking our opinion on things. And then they actually put together a step-down committee that included corrections officers, not lieutenants and captains, corrections officers, sergeants, lieutenants, food service, maintenance, clerical, in any department. And this was under Superintendent Beard's direction, put this together, and that was the best thing that I've ever seen, because everybody had a say. You sat in this meeting, and it wasn't like you were afraid to talk. They asked you a question, and you give them your opinion. We're thinking of giving them showers next week. What do you think about that? What kind of concerns do you have? That's just an example. Mm-hmm. And me being from security, I was able to say, okay, here's the concerns I have. We don't have enough officers, unless we move officers from one cell block to another. In other words, they gave you a mission and said, how are you going to do it, rather than just do this and worry about how you're going to do it later on.
Right.
But I'm telling you, the state police and Superintendent Beard and his staff, they saved us. They really did. State police saved us from the riot, and Superintendent Beard saved us to move forward and open up, because he had a tough job. No one knew him. I didn't know him. No one knew him. No one knew if they could trust him. And we all were questioning, a lot of things. And, I'm not going to blame anything on anybody for the riot. I mean, it was a horrible situation. We all have something that we probably could have done. But Superintendent Beard and his staff really did a tremendous job in getting the place open up again. Yep, they opened it up slow. And with the input of all the officers, all the staff, clerical, whoever was involved in the running of the institution, you were part of it, the step-down committee. So
kind of helped to make you whole again.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it gave us hope, like, okay, maybe we are going to have an institution. Maybe we are going to be able to open things up. And he was, he was reassuring. He said, we're going to have a jail here.
And by giving you guys a voice, it gave you your power back, made you part of the team.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, it was, they would ask your opinion, or they would say something, and they didn't expect you to just sit there and nod your head forward. Yeah, you're right. It's like a basketball coach asking his assistant coach, how we doing, coach? Oh, you're doing fine, coach, but we're 0-20. We haven't won a game yet this year. Oh, but you're doing good, they wanted you to open your mouth. They wanted you to tell the truth. Now, they didn't always agree with everything you said, but you had to say, and they listened to it. And that was, we did. I can only speak for myself.
Right.
I appreciate it. I felt like, and then if things go wrong, then you're not pointing fingers, because you had a part of it. And it was difficult because, I'm speaking about me personally. Part of the step-down committee, I had to answer to the officers. They're like, what do you mean you're going to give them showers? They don't deserve showers, all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, well, you can't keep them locked up forever. We're going to eventually have to give them a shower. But we're going to do it our way. We're going to do, two at a time with 10 officers. It's going to be very safe. Yeah. And that's what we did. It took us maybe days to shower a cell block.
Wow.
But we did it. And, the inmates knew that, they're showering us. They knew eventually we would get to them. And then, slowly but surely, the institution started opening. I remember yard when it opened up, we sectioned off all the yards, and we would let one cell block out at a time. And the inmates could bring absolutely nothing out to the yard with them. And it was nice because it was enforced, too, and we were able to enforce it. So the opening up part was, for me, me personally, Superintendent Beard's direction, it was the way to go. Yep.
Talk to me about then. Now we'll move forward. When you're at the academy, and talk to me about what our CERT teams were like before, and then what you helped turn it into.
Well, I was fortunate to be on Camp Hill CERT team at the time of the riot. But at that time, I don't know how else to say it, but it was like a paper tiger. It was like a policy, but it had no teeth. I mean, we. He had names on the sheet of paper, but our training consisted of huddling up in an office and them showing us a 3-foot wooden riot baton and then going through a couple motions with it, and then you were trained. You were ready to go. So there really wasn't much training. And in the leader's defense, they didn't have much training either. They didn't know how to lead, we didn't know how to follow, and we didn't have the equipment to be an effective riot squad at that time, they called it. Now, some institutions were farther ahead than others. I mean, there were, but Camp Hill wasn't at the time. So they decided that we need to have standardized training for all the CERT teams throughout the state. Every institution is going to have one, and they're going to all be trained the same way by the same persons. So Randy Pollock and Ron Griffith developed the program, and I helped them implement it. And then ended up going around training all the institutions, got some pride back in the institutions.
Because that riot actually impacted everybody. So
absolutely.
It wasn't just something that was localized.
Nope.
So bring that pride back.
It did, and you know, later on in my career, I was fortunate enough to get the major's position at Frackville. And when I went to Frackville and walked into the institution, I knew half of the officers, mm-hmm. or maybe 3/4 of them, just from working with them for 6 months after the riot. Every institution was sending staff down for like 6 months after the riot to work with us, because without them, we couldn't do it. We couldn't run an institution. And until we got all of our staff back, got our staff up to complement as far as, you know, vacancies, because there was a ton of vacancies. And plus, all the ones were injured, all the ones that were out on psychological leave, you know, there was a lot of openings. So all the officers from throughout the state sacrificed their time and their families and came and helped us out.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we will be indebted to them forever, them and the state police. Yep. Yep. So, but I don't even know if this is the right word, but a lot of good came out of it. You know, we realized that we have to do some things different, that security is important in the facilities. Not to say that treatment isn't, but, you know, it's hard to run a treatment program when you don't have security.
Right.
You know, one needs the other.
Correct.
And so that, I think that helped. Communication with staff helped for the most part. We learned from it. A lot of policies were changed. Emergency response changed. Now these institutions that we trained their teams, now they had mandatory training where they had, you know, so many hours, I forget now, but so many hours of training just to be a CERT officer.
Not
like
just
40 hours.
At a baton.
Right. Not just to show up
actual
and graduate
physical.
Class. Yeah.
Yeah.
You actually had a leave some sweat. You had a physical fitness standards, and you had firearms proficiency tests, and you had to actually earn it.
And
it
equipment.
Wasn't any equipment, and the best equipment that we can find. We did. We had good equipment, so it was a morale booster for the institutions, and then it progressed from there. Then we went from there to sniper teams, and then we went from sniper teams to hostage recovery teams, and you know, I was happy that, you know, I was there to see all that happen. And it was fun. And then we had canine teams, and I remember, I'm not gonna say who it was, but it's like, what do you think about canines? Ah, we'll never have canines here. No, it's just show dogs. We don't need show dogs in here. And that's funny, I said, because a lot of the larger departments, they have them, and they're effective. You know, they use them in their visiting room. Well, we'll never have it here.
Well, we started with 4, and I think we have like 25.
Yeah, I know.
So.
And I think Commissioner Lehman is the one, or Marty Horn. Got that started.
Yeah.
And he was another one that was unbelievable. I mean, you can go in and knock on his office door and go in and ask him a question and he'll give you an answer. And if you had something good to say, he would say, okay, let's do it. And he was good at it. He was good. So, you know, we went from that. Then we got the canine teams. We got trained sniper teams, trained hostage recovery teams, trained hostage negotiators. I mean, the whole program, the whole emergency response program came together. And I've been retired for a while. I'm hoping that it still is, because it still has a special place in my heart. You know, I still have my hat. I look at it all the time, and I I take a lot of pride in that. Yeah. I really do, because
they are all still in existence.
Yep. And I just hope it continues on.
Yeah.
But and then eventually we actually did open the institution. And but again, it opened slow, so I really couldn't even tell you the date because it was opening for a couple of years.
And even the staging down of the state police too.
Right.
I remember when it was time for them to all be gone,
mm-hmm.
just kind of looking out the window, thinking, "Oh boy,
yep.
it was a big move."
Yeah, it was, and the big move was escorting an inmate without a state trooper with a shotgun with you, because anytime an inmate came out of a cell block or was moved, there had to been a state police officer there with a shotgun. Yeah, anytime they moved. When we were walking them in the showers, state police were there with shotguns.
And some of those guys were just sitting in the yard throughout the whole thing, may not have been involved, correct?
Right.
So, but they all got treated the same.
And, you know, the inmates learned from it. You know, they were stuck in a cell with people they didn't know. And because everything, we were starting to have problems, inmates on inmates, so we actually handcuffed the inmates in the cells. We leg ironed them to different things so they couldn't get at each other, and just to keep everybody safe. So
and then
the inmates,
the conditions of confinement lawsuit,
right,
that was brought,
right,
so.
And it was really to protect them.
Right.
And not for us. We had no enjoyment out of that. It's, you know, it's to protect them, you know. And so the inmates didn't like it either. So I don't think they want to go through another one either right now. But how soon people forget, that's the only thing that I worry about every day. As
but
soon as
another,
we forget that, then
yeah.
You know, it goes in cycles. So.
And another major thing, or an amazing thing, is how vivid everything is 30 years later. It's just like you can see it.
It's our 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not diminishing 9/11, believe me, by saying that. But you know, to me, 10/26/89 sticks in my mind just as clear as 9/11 does.
Right.
It really does.
One of the biggest things you've experienced.
Yep. And I got to be honest with you, this is the most I've ever talked about it since it happened. I in training, I'd use bits and pieces to try to help reinforce what we were training them to do. But as far as, you know, a lot of people on the street, they want to ask you questions about it, and I would just be real vague. But it's not something that you like to talk about, and I don't think anybody, I think everybody else is probably, it's not something that was enjoyable. You know, I don't like to talk about what I just talked about. I really don't.
Right.
Because it brings back bad memories. That was one of the worst days of my life.
Right.
So
did you have nightmares afterwards?
Absolutely. Yeah, you couldn't
sleep. I hope this doesn't bring nightmares back to you.
No way. But yeah, you can't sleep. You just keep hearing the voices of people on the radio calling for help. And just seeing the families. You know, John's wife, you know, just crushed. Crushed, and seeing Tommy Campbell in the hospital, his legs, you know, three times the size, and they had actually cut him open, and because inmates were just standing there beating him with a board, you know, it just makes you angry. It really does. It makes you angry.
Yeah.
And
now you know why they took the.
And then sitting
away.
There, yeah, you know, and then sitting there watching your fellow officers get beat and not being able to do anything about it. That if that doesn't affect you, nothing will. And you know. I'll take that to my grave with me. It's something that I hate it, but.
Do you have a military background?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
Okay.
No, I graduated from high school in 73, and that's when the draft was over.
Uh-huh.
I remember my brother tried to talk me into going because he was in the Air Force, and so I tried to go in. They wouldn't even take me. They're like, "Nah, we're not taking anybody right now." Couldn't even get in if I wanted to.
Interesting.
But.
Is there anything else you wanted to?
No, I think we're on the right track. We were on the right track in preparing institutions to handle situations like this. But the second part of it is that if it does happen again, you know, don't forget the hostages and don't forget their families. You know, it's not just when are they going to come back to work. It's they're going to have to work through things. And I remember some of the kids to some of their dads were like, you know, scared to death. You know, seeing on TV what was going on and them knowing that their dads were there.
Mm-hmm.
And because I talked to them, you know, we all did, you know, the group of us just tried to just make our rounds, just going around trying to, you know, talk to the hostages and their families, take them out for dinner, just try and give them some kind of support. And but they're the forgotten ones, because after it happens, you know, you administration and institutions are so busy trying to get things back up and running, excuse me, that you forget about that.
Yeah.
And but you know, I appreciate this opportunity. Again, I was reluctant to do it, but when you had said that it'll help other officers in the future do their job and understand what happened, so if they understand what happened, to help them prevent it from happening again, then I'm all for it. And that's why I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you.
Because I know you were here throughout the whole thing. And so it's...
I think it's time.
I think it'll be, if it's used in the right way, I think people will learn from it.
Great.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.